This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon, coast to coast, from Los Angeles to New York, from San Francisco to Pittsburgh, noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time, 5 days a week. Well, the Democratic debates were up last night. In the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking about them in some detail. And, you know, what was the consequence? Who won? What happened? What issues were brought up? But first, in the third hour of our program, by the way, we're going to be talking with Gene Rurka of the Explorers Club about some very strange foods. And Larry Scott from the VAWatchdog.org group will be with us. But in the first hour, I wanted to get into an issue that was brought up last night during the debates, and that is Social Security. Hillary Clinton will not say that she will eliminate the cap on Social Security so that Bill Gates, for example, will pay the exact same percentage of his income on Social Security taxes as I do and most working Americans do. Right now, Social Security tax is strictly a tax on the working poor and the middle class. The wealthy and the extremely wealthy do not pay beyond the first 90-some-odd thousand dollars of their income, do not pay into the Social Security fund. And if that cap was eliminated, of course, it would solve all problems of Social Security forever. As it is, Social Security won't have a problem for another 20 years at the very least. But the benefits now only rising 2.3% this year. Should we even have Social Security? George Walker Bush, George W. Bush, in 1977, when he ran for the House of Representatives unsuccessfully from Texas, the cornerstone of his campaign was privatizing Social Security, making it no longer a government program. This is a strong meme in the Republican Party. Our quote for the day from Dwight Eisenhower: should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear that party again in our political history. There's a tiny splinter group, of course, that believes you can do these things. Among them are H.L. Hunt and a few other Texas oil millionaires and an occasional politician or businessman from other areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. This is a letter from Dwight Eisenhower to his brother David. Of course, he was speaking of stupid politically. Yaron Brook is with us. He is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand, the creator of the flame of objectivism. And Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks, and thanks for that intro.
Yeah, well, I know that you're not stupid. You're one of the smartest guys I know, and I respect your intellect tremendously. Even though we disagree on so many things, there's actually a fair number of things that we agree on as well, but the disagreements are more interesting, I think. You're taking the Ron Paul position, and I think most people don't realize this is the Ron Paul position, the libertarian position, which is that there should simply be no Social Security. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fundamentally immoral system. It's a system that penalizes people who would save and rewards people who wouldn't save. Without, if you didn't have Social Security, some people would save, maybe some people wouldn't save. The people who didn't save for retirement would suffer the consequence of that, and the people who saved would have a much better retirement than with Social Security. What Social Security does is it creates a disincentive to save for everybody. It creates this notion that the government will take care of us, and it rewards those people who wouldn't have saved at the expense of others, and I think that's just wrong. I think the issue of saving for retirement should be left up to individuals, and then, you know, if you want a system that protects people, you know, from misfortune or from the fact that they didn't save, then call it what it is. Call it a welfare program. You know, let's have a specific tax that is related to that. But don't have the illusion that this is somehow a savings program that protects everybody.
It's a redistribution of
wealth. Let's call it what it really is.
Sure, I'll agree with that. First of all, that it's a redistribution of wealth, and I think a good one. First of all, about a third of all Social Security payments do not go to retired persons. They go to people who have injured themselves so badly, like my friend Michael Hutchison in New York. He fell down, broke his neck. He fell off a bridge, and he's paralyzed. I mean, he's living on Social Security. It's the only thing that's keeping him alive, quite literally.
Well, of course, there is insurance that covers that. It's called disability insurance, and he could have purchased that. And, of course, again, Social Security creates a disincentive.
Which brings me to my second point, Aaron. I got that. Which brings me to my second point. If we're going to have an insurance policy, and we're talking actually insurance here, in this case it's insurance against poverty and old age. Right now the old age poverty level in the United States is 11.9%. Without Social Security it would be 47.6% of seniors would be living in poverty. If we're going to have insurance against poverty and insurance against disasters, widows and orphans and injured people, disabled people, if we're going to have that, why would we want to have a for-profit corporation running that? Why not have a not-for-profit organization doing it, which is 100% answerable to we the people every 2 years in the ballot in the electoral process? In other words, the government through Social Security.
Well, because it's not insurance. The whole idea of insurance is that you pay based on risk. So if you live in an earthquake zone, you pay a higher rate for earthquake insurance than if you live in the Midwest. It's zero in the Midwest. The risk of me
broadly,
being,
but wait, respectfully, that's a secondary.
Let me say, if I save a lot of money during my life and therefore don't face the risk of poverty when I retire, why should I pay the same rate as somebody who does face, who's not?
No, I understand that. And if everybody in America, if you could graduate from high school and have a job where you knew that you could put your kids through school, your medical expenses were covered, you could buy a home, and you could save for old age, the criteria that Teddy Roosevelt defined as a living wage, I might be inclined to start to agree with you. But the reality is that most people who are working in America can't save enough to have retirement in their old age.
Sure they can. Sure they can. Particularly if we cut taxes and let them have more of the income that they produce.
You've got people who are not paying income taxes, Walmart.
What is the rate of return on Social Security? It's at best 2 to 3%. At worst, it's negative for some people. I could put the money in a money market account, the same amount I pay for Social Security. I could put it into a money market account and do better than what Social Security provides me. Social Security is an awful saving plan, and the only thing it protects you from.
It's not a savings plan. It's an insurance program. And the point of insurance is to spread risk as broadly as possible. It's not just to pay based on risk. If the goal of insurance was to have people pay based on risk, then the insurance companies would say to you, oh, look at that, you've had cancer, we will no longer insure. Well, actually, I guess they're doing that now, aren't they? But that's not
that.
How it's supposed
Absolutely.
To work. The way it's
supposed It's not insurance.
No, they shouldn't.
And that's why
this has to be run by the government rather than a for-profit company, because this is this is the community of us providing for ourselves.
You're right. A system like Social Security can only be run by the government. I'm not for privatizing it. I'm for doing away with it. But a system like Social Security is corrupt, immoral, and bad economics. It's bad for everybody, including the poor. It's not a good system, and only the government could run it because it's so bad. It could only be a government program. It could never survive in the private markets.
Social Security took us from the major cause of death among elderly people being hypothermia in the winter and malnutrition in the summer in the 1930s during the Great Depression. Took us from that to now only an 11% poverty rate among elderly people.
Yeah, and I think
Social Security has saved a lot of lives, Yaron.
Yeah, I don't think Social Security is the cause of that. The cause of that is the immense increase in wealth that has been created in this economy over the last...
No, it did within the first year, 1936.
And that creation of wealth has to do with the private economy and has nothing to do with government. Indeed, if we didn't have Social Security and such huge government intervention, standard of living would be much higher today and people would be living longer and much better lives, including the poor. The poor would be much better off without Social Security, without all the social programs, the rest of the social programs the government engages in.
You know, we had terrible poverty in the United States from the 1830s until the 1930s. There was the depressions of 1848, 1849, and the depressions of the 1870s.
There was no wealth. wealth.
No,
has
there
been
was there
created.
Was enormous wealth during there the robber baron era in the 1890s. You had the average income in the United States in the census of 1900 was $9,700. Most Americans lived in poverty from basically just before the Civil War until Franklin Roosevelt came along with the New Deal.
I mean, it's ridiculous. We're using modern terms to explain what happened 100.
No, but that
years
was
ago.
When we were running there the economy was. The way you want to run.
That's right, and I think we need to run it again that way, and I think that 1870, if you compare 1870 to 1800 or to 1700, people were living 1,000 times better. The definition of poverty, the whole idea of poverty is a modern term because up until capitalism, everybody was living hand to mouth. They were living subsistence. They were barely surviving and dying of diseases. Capitalism is what's allowed us to even have such a thing as people who are, relatively in poverty, but it's only a relative term. They live much better than ever before.
Yeah, I'm not here to trash capitalism. I'm here to defend Social Security. But your point is well made, even though we disagree.
Yep.
IanRand.org, the website. Yaron Brook, always great having you, Yaron. Thanks for dropping by.
Bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, it's Halloween, I guess. That's the one Rolling Stones song that always totally creeped me out. I gotta tell you. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, this Saturday I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm keynoting the Holistic Management International Conference. I'll be doing a book signing at Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. That's on the northwest corner of Tramway and Candelaria. And please drop by and say hi. And on the 5th of November, the Monday night of next week at 7:30 p.m., Powell's Bookstore here in Portland, I'll be signing. This is all for Cracking the Code, my new book, the book that we in part wrote on the air over the course of the last year on the art and science of political communication. And then on November 9th, next Friday, a week from this Friday, I'll be in Phoenix signing books at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills in Tempe from 3 to 5 p.m. And tickets are on sale through the website at 1480kphx.com. So that should be a lot of fun. Social Security. There are so many memes out there about Social Security that are so, in a way, fundamentally destructive. The Republicans like George W. Bush and conservatives who believe that Social Security is socialized stuff, is socialism, and therefore should be done away with, that we don't live in a we society, we live in a me society, that if the majority of the people want something, they shouldn't have it anyway because they don't really believe in democracy. The conservatives and the Republicans out there who are gung-ho on this stuff put out these things like, well, you want to get your maximum return on your investment with Social Security. Social Security is not an investment. It's an insurance program. In fact, the name of the program is that it's an insurance program. The name of the program is the Federal Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance Program, OASDI. So, just go over to Wikipedia and Google Social Security. There it is, right at the top. Not that the Wikipedia is the ultimate authority, but that's actually what the name is. So, number one, it's not an investment. It's an insurance program. About a third of the people who are getting these funds are people who literally need it to survive on, literally widows, orphans, and disabled people, number one. So it's about the we society. Secondly, it's insurance against poverty and old age. It's not a retirement program. No, but, to retire on Social Security is to retire living absolutely on the edge. I can't seriously believe that anybody in America is looking at the what's $500, $600, $700, $800, $900 a month you might get, depending on how much you paid into Social Security, and saying, oh yeah, I'm looking forward to retiring on that. Come on. Come on. This is, in my opinion, frankly, is not a disincentive to saving. And, but the meme that is put out is largely targeted toward young people. The Republicans are really targeting this thing to young people, saying, well, Democrats don't care about the interests of young people. They only want to pander to the old farts to get their votes. And selfish old people and their special interest lobby, you know, like the AARP. And I want to prevent young people from getting the benefits of free market. All of this ignores a bunch of illusions. First of all, Social Security is an anti-poverty insurance program, not an investment program. Secondly, that this iceberg that Social Security will hit, all those numbers, all those scary Social Security is going to go broke in 2042, et cetera, numbers, those are all based on the worst slow growth assumptions from the year 2001 after 9/11 and 2002. They're based on like 2% annual growth rate or less assumptions. If Social Security, if the economy grows at the same rate that it grew during the Clinton administration, Social Security would be fine if we did nothing. And if it doesn't grow that fast, if we continue with Reaganomics and Bushonomics, God forbid, then all you have to do is lift the cap. Right now, people only pay into the Social Security fund. They only pay Social Security taxes on their first 90-some-odd thousand dollars. I think it's $96,000 or $97,000 of income. So if somebody makes $1 million a year, they're only paying Social Security tax. They're not paying a penny of Social Security tax on $900,000 plus of that $1 million a year. If somebody makes, you know, like William McGuire, the guy who left American healthcare, $1.78 billion in compensation, or the top hedge fund manager in Wall Street last year made $1.5 billion, $1,500 million. How much of that did he pay Social Security taxes on? Virtually nothing. The first $97,000. That was it. So on $1,499,010,000, he paid no Social Security tax whatsoever. Is that right? I don't think so. This is as regressive as a tax can get. Let's just eliminate the cap. And that's what many, if not most, of the Democratic candidates are calling for. And it's what was discussed in the Democratic debate last night. And there are a few candidates who are saying, well, no, we want to think about it. We want to talk about it. I'm not going to weigh in here. But I suspect that whoever is elected president, if it's a Democrat, is going to end up doing the right thing and blowing that cap off. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now, you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you. The boy said, my name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet, you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia, and the devil deals in cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul.
Happy Halloween! May we all avoid such a fate. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com. We'll get you there. Their blog is also over at AirAmerica.com. And Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I had a couple of comments. First of all, this guy that you were talking to, it makes me sick. I'm a Social Security disability attorney. And you defended the Social Security very well. You left out one thing. A lot of people are on disability for illness, not just injuries.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, you know, I realized a while back I was arguing with a conservative, and I realized that we have three choices of what we can do with our disabled and weak and old people. We can help them, or we can just let them starve in the streets like they do in places like India, or we can kill them like the Nazis did. And those are our only three choices. And I say we should help them. That's the only humane and decent thing to do. And the other comment I had is this. The problem with this guy, it's the same problem that I hear so often over and over again with these conservatives, is that, you know, in theory, their ideas seem reasonable. They seem like good ideas in theory. But in practice, we have people who cannot work and they have no money. So, I mean, they have no empathy for these people who otherwise would starve. And they expect everybody to act like logical robots and do the right thing and buy insurance and save money for retirement. But people are not logical robots. They make mistakes all the time. And there's no reason why we as a society can't get together and help these people instead of just letting them starve to death.
Amen. Well said, Steve. Thank you very much. And I would go even beyond that and say that one of the biggest problems we have in the United States as a consequence of conservative economic policies, of Reagan rolling back the New Deal, basically the end of the New Deal era began in 1981. We had the New Deal from 1933 for all practical purposes until 1981. And then when Reagan was inaugurated, he went after the labor unions. He started going after Social Security, went after everything. And now most people are not earning enough money that they can save for old age, and they're not earning enough money that their house will be paid off when they retire. And they're not, you know, that's the dream of my parents' generation, not of this generation and not of my children's generation. Similarly, this Michael Gerson, by the way, Bush's former speechwriter, has a new book out and apparently is riffing about Cheney. This from the Washington Post today. For Michael Gerson, the pattern became discouragingly familiar. A proposal to help the poor or sick would be presented at a White House meeting, but Vice President Cheney's office or the budget team or some other skeptical officials would shoot it down. Too expensive. Wrong priority. Gerson writes that he urged Bush to fire Rumsfeld after the 2004 election, but that Cheney opposed the move. He recounts meetings in which Cheney's office tried to kill proposals to assist training to death row defense lawyers, transition assistance for prisoners, and aid for Hurricane Katrina victims. I mean, it is really...
You're a monster, Mr. Grinch.
Yeah, I mean, it's Halloween.
Your heart's an empty hole.
Halloween and Cheney.
Your brain is full of spiders.
And the conservatives.
You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch.
Yeah, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Walt in Vancouver. Hey, Walt.
Hey, Tom. That was quick. I'm a retired Social Security supervisor. I retired. It's been 15 years now, but I'm still somewhat familiar with the way the program works. I worked for 31 years for the Social Security Administration.
Thank you. Social Security has never missed a check. You know,
right.
I mean, it just, you guys, you know, no offense, but, you know, good, boring, bureaucratic administrators taking their job seriously, having a decent job with decent pay and a decent pension, doing the job right, doing it throughout their careers, not trying to become Michael Milkins and become a billionaire, you know, as an investment scheme or something. You guys did great, and you're doing great.
Well, one of the points I want to make is that, Of course, nobody anticipated the kind of baby boom we were going to have after the war, although when it did materialize, I recall when I was back in training back in Baltimore in the early 60s, we were back there for 3 weeks for an orientation and, you know, brainwashing, as you will, in any organization. And after the daily classes, well, we'd get together in various spots around Baltimore, and one night, a couple of fellows and I went to this place that was a regular hangout for Social Security people around the headquarters buildings there.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. It was a combination, they call it a beer stube and bookstore, and a lot of the old heads hung out there. And we sat down with these two graybeards who were, you know, fellows who were at that time close to my age now. And they were among the minor architects of the program back in the 30s.
Wow.
And I couldn't give you a name or anything else. They were just fellows that we met there. And among the things that were talked about at that time were the fact that there was going to be a big bulge in the demand on the
with the boomers. Well, you know that the boomers are the only generation prior to 82 or 83, whenever the Greenspan commission came out with its findings, and Reagan pretty much doubled the Social Security tax, the largest tax increase in the history of the United States that only hit the middle class and the working poor, by the way. Prior to that time, every generation paid for the retirement of their parents' generation and their
right.
grandparents' generation. The baby boomers are the only generation that has in the past or will in the future, because it's going to end in 2035 or 2045 or whatever it is, will both pay for their parents' retirement. In other words, my generation, I paid for my dad's retirement with my Social Security taxes.
Right.
I'm also paying for my own retirement by putting aside money into the trust fund, which didn't exist before 82 or 83 and will not exist after 2040-something.
The trust fund was were established early on in the program. There always were trust funds. They were
not for this purpose. Not for dealing with this python going or this rabbit going
through
the python.
It was more of a pay as you go thing. But
right.
the 86 amendments, I forget which, jacked that up a little bit so that there would be an accumulation to account for the baby. But anyway, one of the things they talked about was that there was a lot of talk early on that if this sort of thing occurred, there should be no problem. They were thinking in New Deal terms of a strong Democratic Party, that there would be no problem to infuse some general taxation funds money into the trust funds.
Right.
And that of course is anathema to the people that are in charge right now.
Yeah.
And I think to a lot of the people in the Democratic Party who were sitting in Congress,
yeah.
But that's...
No, you're absolutely right. Walt, I've got to move along, but interesting point. I mean, the bottom line is ultimately they're going to have to put some general fund money in there because the general fund has borrowed billions and hundreds of billions of dollars from Social Security, perhaps $1 trillion. I'm not sure. I would guess it's probably at least that from Social Security, so it's going to have to pay it back. So that's going to happen one way or another. But just lifting the cap, I mean, you know, just this is not rocket science. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just want to say to your guy from Iran, let's take it on what he's saying. You do all this stuff right. You go, you invest in your pensions, you go put money in the market, you do all this stuff, and then you end up like the people from Enron that lose everything and thanking God that they got Social Security left after that disaster and all these other companies that rolled out and wouldn't pay the people the pension that they put in. Then
right.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Very well said, Kenny. Thank you very much. Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank.
Well, you know, in Costa Rica, the right wing brings that up as an example of success, but it's really a failure because the people that opt to privatize Social Security lost all their money, and now they have to go back to work. But the fact is...
Yeah, same thing in Chile and Argentina.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the game here is that once they privatize it, your corporation won't have to put half of that money into the Social Security fund.
That's the bottom line, yeah.
The game is. And, you know, there's over 40 million people at the poverty level, and this guy says that, another thing
they can say for
trying to do with this game is that put out the burden on the states. When Reagan got into office, he stopped sharing the funds, you know, reversing some of that money that they collected from the states back to the states, and the states start looking for other means of collecting money, you know, by raising sales taxes and licensing fees and all that. So,
absolutely, Frank.
This is the one game that they're playing, and they can, you know.
It's all about squeeze as much as you can out of the middle class and the working poor, and give as much as you can to the millionaires and billionaires. That's the conservative agenda. That's the Republican agenda in a nutshell. And I defy anybody to demonstrate otherwise. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Actually, there is something strange out there, and it does look kind of weird. It's the Republican pack of presidential contenders. They need an exorcism in New Hampshire, I think. Oh, my. Strange stuff going on in the world, and of course, it's Halloween, so last night Tim Russert had to ask Dennis Kucinich if he'd seen a flying saucer, and Kucinich said yes, and he said, by the way, others have as well.
And also, you have to keep in mind that Jimmy Carter saw a UFO, and also that more people in this country have seen UFOs, and I think approve of George Bush's presidency.
Actually,
we're just getting started here.
No. I mean, we have about 14% of Americans say they have seen UFOs. I'm going to move.
What was the percentage?
14%.
What was that percentage?
14.
You guys are trying to establish. He's not totally outside the mainstream. Well, I think I've seen a UFO. I'll put myself in that 14%. But the reality is that 36% of Americans believe that UFOs are real. And so, you know, that's 23% of Americans say that they've seen a ghost. That's pretty amazing. And I mean, particularly when you consider that 24% of Americans approve of George Bush, so which I think was Dennis Kucinich's point, and a good point it was. It was. And we'll be talking about the presidential debate in the next hour at some considerable length. 1-866-303-2270. Ken in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Tom. I can't for the life of me understand why the Democrats are not more successful in convincing middle-class, so-called cloth-coat Republicans from all over the country that they've been fed a line of bull and that they're drinking the Wall Street Kool-Aid, that they've succumbed to the Wall Street wing of the Republican Party, and they're being victimized just as much as anybody else.
I agree, and at the risk of sounding like self-promotion, I really don't mean it as such. That's why I wrote Screwed, which is all about how the cons are screwing the middle class, and why I wrote Cracking the Code, about how the Democrats can be talking back and what they should be doing. And I'm not the only one. There's a number of excellent books out there. David Sirota's work is brilliant. Barbara Ehrenreich's work, Nickel and Dimed, and others. I mean, we're starting to get the word out. Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas? We're starting to get the word out, but I agree with you, Ken. It's like, you know, the Republicans just don't get, or it's Nixon's Southern strategy. You know, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he was advised, if you sign this, the Democratic Party's going to lose the South for a generation. They're going to lose the racist vote. And he said, I'm willing to do that. That's the price for doing the right thing. I'm willing to do that. And he signed the legislation. And Nixon came along with the Southern strategy and overtly, specifically, explicitly said, we're going after the racists in the South. And the Republicans have owned the racist vote ever since. And so there's, you know, things like race and homophobia. I mean, the Republicans basically campaign on fear. And when they can trump everything else with fear, including the fear of the terrorists are going to get you, the brown people from Mexico are going to get you, the gays are going to get you. I mean, this is, it's all about fear. And the Democrats, thank God, are talking about hope. They're talking about a vision for the future. Stacey in Los Angeles. Hey, Stacey.
Morning, Tom. You know, I know that you respect that your guest's intellect, but frankly, what value is intellect if you have no empathy at all? I used to be a court reporter, and I made a very nice living, and I worked really hard, and I developed severe carpal tunnel in both my hands, not just carpal tunnel, but severe, so severe that when I had the nerve conduction studies, my numbers were so low they were almost off the chart. The doctor said he'd never seen anybody. I mean, you could stick a pin in my finger, and I didn't feel it. And wow. I had a private disability policy that I paid a lot of money for. Well, guess what? They denied my claim. They told me I needed to go back to work and completely lose the use of my hands, and then they would pay me. So what good is it? I mean, I had surgery, and my surgeon said to me, if you go back to work, it's coming back again. I can't fix you the next time. And, you know, right. Maybe I'm silly. I just thought I'd rather have the use of my hands. So all that money I paid for all those years. So what value is it to have a private disability policy when you know that the only thing insurance companies want to do is not pay the claims?
Yeah, that's the business that they're in, is making money.
Exactly.
And the way that they make money is by not paying claims, you know, by collect. This bleeds into the health insurance debate, which is, you know, conservatives again say, well, you don't want socialized medicine. You don't want some government official making decisions about what kind of medical services are available to you, are you? Do you? Well, if the choice is you know, socialized medicine where the bureaucrats are, the government, that is, people that I can go to the polls every 2 years and throw out on their butts, versus socialized medicine where the bureaucrats are multi-billionaires who probably live in the Cayman Islands or certainly have their legal residence there so they don't have to pay taxes, and I can't vote for them, I can't throw them out on their butts, I can't even get a phone call through to them, and if I try to call one of their minions, I end up talking to somebody in India, I'll take the government every day, thank you very much, because they're at least, you know, have to be responsive to me in a democracy. Stacey, brilliant.
Can I just say one thing? It's just so annoying. I don't know what planet that your guest lives on, but the planet I live on, most people don't make enough money to be able to save for retirement. And if one serious thing happens to them, they're wiped out. And that's why Social Security I can't believe that people don't realize why Social Security was developed. And it's not the best solution, but for most people, it's the only solution. And with regard to the health insurance, just to piggyback onto that, the little two-year-old girl, Bethany Wilkerson, who the right wing went after last week when her family came out as part of the plea to pass the S-CHIP program, her mother was on Keith Olbermann and said she would love to get insurance, pay private insurance for her. Guess what? She can't. She's excluded because she has a pre-existing condition.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, all the more the disaster that it's all about profit. It's all about making money. And you know, this is, and these conservatives, they have this religion that somehow the, quote, free market, end quote, and there ain't no such thing, but this mythical free market, this mythical invisible hand that Adam Smith only mentioned once in his book Wealth of Nations in 1776, and even then as a cautionary note, this mythical free, the invisible hand is somehow going to save us all. I'm sorry, it's not. That's why we created the United States of America. That's why people gather together to form governments to protect themselves collectively, in some cases, from predators like these corporations. Thank you, Stacey, for the call. 57 minutes past the hour. Next hour, what happened last night in the debate?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So last night was the Democratic debate, the most recent of the Democratic debates. And a number of issues came up, and there were some high points and some low points. It was one of the things that I found most interesting was how Barack Obama had, prior to the debate, for reasons that I can only guess at, I'm guessing that the strategy was to try to amp up the number of people watching the debate in anticipation of his being able to hit one out of the ballpark while he has a larger audience. Although maybe it was just not a well thought out comment, but basically had said in advance that he was going to take the gloves off, that he was going to go after Hillary Clinton, and had set up this expectation. And for several days, Chris Matthews was like, let me give you your talking points, Barack. Here's exactly what you should say. And Chris Matthews, by the way, was exactly right in what he was saying that Barack Obama should be saying. And Obama last night didn't do it. He didn't do it. I mean, he tried to differentiate himself, but he did it in that almost John Kerry-esque way. It's a kind of an academic, thoughtful, maybe I could still be vice president kind of way. I don't know exactly why he pulled his punches, but John Edwards was not pulling punches. Joe Biden was not pulling punches. The other thing that we learned is that Bill Richardson is definitely running for vice president, because as soon as everybody started piling on to Hillary Clinton, Richardson comes along and says, let's not make this about personal attacks. Let's not pick on Hillary. And then, of course, he picked on Hillary, too. But you know, don't forget me. I'd make a great vice president. I really think that that's what he was saying. Joe Biden, though, in my mind, said some great things last night. One of them in particular, this had to be the high point of the evening.
And the irony is Rudy Giuliani, probably the most underqualified man since George Bush to seek the presidency, is here talking about any of the people here. Rudy Giuliani. I mean, think about it. Rudy Giuliani, there's only three things he mentioned in a sentence, a noun and a verb and 9/11. I mean, there's nothing else. There's nothing else. And I mean it sincerely. He is genuinely not qualified to be president.
To be president. He's genuinely not qualified to be president. In fact, every time you see a picture of Rudy Giuliani running down the street through all the dust and rubble of 9/11, remember that the reason he was running down the street is because his emergency headquarters had been blown up because, like an idiot, he put it in the World Trade Center against the advice of the fire department, against the advice of his security advisors, against everybody's advice. And in exchange for putting it in the World Trade Center, he got a $100,000 donation from the owner of the World Trade Center. Or the management of the World Trade Center, one or the other. But he got a $100,000 campaign contribution the next day, the day after he signed the contract to put his emergency headquarters there. So Joe Biden, spot on, Joe. Well said. John Edwards had a few extraordinary moments during the debate last night.
This is not about the past. This is about the future. This is about whether we believe this system works. I mean, we are here in Philadelphia where the founding fathers decided that the power, the sovereign power in this government, should not reside with the rich and the powerful. It ought to reside with the people. And everybody in America can see what's happening now. We don't have universal health care because of drug companies, insurance companies, and their lobbyists. The reason we haven't tackled global warming is because of oil companies, power companies, and their lobbyists. And the question is, what are we going to do for our children? I mean, I'll say this to every voter who's watching this debate. Listen, we've all stood by and watched this happen. That includes me. I'm guilty. Guilty as charged. But the question is, are you willing to look your children in the eye tonight and say, I'm going to turn this mess over to you? Because if you turn your back on the incompetence and the corruption that exists in Washington today, that's exactly what you're saying. You're saying, I'm going to let my children and my grandchildren take care of that.
Now, that was brilliant, and it was also stupid. And let me explain why. It was brilliant in it was a sentiment that we all agree with and everybody wanted to hear. Here's a guy who actually isn't, unlike Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, is not taking money from PACs and lobbyists. And in fact, day before yesterday pointed out, and again, it didn't get picked up by the media, that Hillary Clinton has taken more money from defense industry lobbyists than any other candidate for president in the Democratic Party, and more money from defense industry lobbyists than any other candidate in the Republican Party. So, I mean, that's something legitimate and serious to point out and to say, hey, you know, here's what's going on. This is something. But toward the end, John Edwards made, in what, in my opinion, is a big mistake in that he used the first person. He used the word I in a negative way. So this is what my new book, Cracking the Code, is all about. There's a chapter specifically about this, how you don't, because the unconscious mind cannot filter the difference between a direct statement to a person and an implicit indirect statement. Just like the unconscious mind can't filter the word no. There's two things in primarily that the unconscious mind cannot filter. The first is no. If I say, don't think about Hillary Clinton, boom, what do you think about? Well, you have to think about her in order to know what to not think about. So it's not possible. So number one, the brain can't you know, at the unconscious level, it can't sort no. So when Richard Nixon says that he is not a crook, everybody is hearing that he is a crook. Okay, number one. But number two, the brain can't filter I and you. It can't filter it out. So when Edwards said toward the end of that, let me see if I've got this cued right.
Because if you turn your back on the incompetence and the corruption that exists in Washington today, that's exactly what you're saying. You're saying, I'm going to let my children and my grandchildren take care of that.
See, now, at the unconscious level, people listening heard him say that he was, and now I'm putting it in the third person because I don't want to say it in the first person, heard him say that he was handing the problems off to his children and grandchildren. So the way that he should have said this, and I realize I'm maybe, you will think I'm picking nits, but this is a really serious point. And this is something that the Republicans understand because Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich have trained them well in NLP and psychology and the techniques of communication. What he should have said is that we do not want to be the people who will have to say to our children that these problems were passed along to them. Or we don't want to be among those Republicans who are passing the problems along to our children. He should have framed it in something other than a quote that has him saying this as if it was him doing it. Because that you know,
and say, I'm going to turn this mess over to you.
See, that it should have been, and say, they're going to turn this, or somebody's going to turn, you know. So just a point that I wanted to make. Also, Edwards and Dodd, primarily Dodd. This is Chris Dodd is calling for the decriminalization of marijuana. I absolutely applaud him on this. He took a courageous stand last night, and Tim Russert asked him about it, and he said, yeah, I'm in favor of decriminalizing it. Edwards said, I'm not. I think it sends a bad message to our kids. You know, I understand that. I think that he's doing that because you could not, I frankly don't think you can get elected president of the United States right now calling for the decriminalization of marijuana. Once you're president, you can bring the issue up. But Chris Dodd, courageously, and Chris Dodd is right on a lot of issues, by the way, courageously said,
We're locking up too many people in our system here today. We've got mandatory minimum sentences. They're filling our jails with people who don't belong there. My idea here is to decriminalize this, reduce that problem here. We've gone from 800,000 to 2 million people in our penal institutions in this country. We've got to get a lot smarter about this issue than we are. And as president, I try and achieve that.
And by the way, at over 2 million people in our prisons, we have more people in prison than China does. And they have three times as many people as we do. We have more people in prison, both on a per capita basis and in absolute numbers, than any other country in the world because of these insane drug laws. This is nuts. This is a medical problem. It should be dealt with as a medical problem, not as a criminal problem. The end of the debate was where everybody says Hillary Clinton got tripped up, and that was, does she support Elliot Spitzer in wanting to give driver's licenses to illegal immigrants, to people who are or undocumented workers, as is the politically correct way to say it? And she waffled on that totally and broadly seemed to be supporting Spitzer, but wasn't willing to condemn him and wasn't willing to come out and say that she supports him. I predict within 24 hours she will have changed her position on this and will say no, she's opposed to driver's licenses for illegal immigrants, because it is the position that will sell in America. And if she says that she's in favor of driver's licenses for illegal immigrants, then we're going to have a Republican president if she's the nominee. I mean, it's just that simple. This is an issue that the Republicans will slice and dice the Democrats with, because even the majority of Democrats don't want illegal immigrants or undocumented workers or whatever you want to call them to have driver's licenses. It's just, I mean, that's the way it is. And I, by the way, I agree with that position that they should not have driver's licenses. Somebody's in this country illegally, they shouldn't have a driver's license. You provide them with health services, sure. The driver's license, no. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Happy Halloween. 21 minutes past the hour. Apparently in the last hour, when we did our Twilight Zone alert about Dennis Kucinich and UFOs, I referred to UFOs as flying saucers, and some of our listeners have taken umbrage with me for that. I apologize. In fact, I think Tim Rosser did the same thing, and Dennis Kucinich set him straight. Here's the original question and response.
Congressman Kucinich, I want to move to a different area because this is a serious question. The godmother of your daughter, Shirley MacLaine, writes in her new book that you sighted a UFO over her home in Washington State, that you found the encounter extremely moving, that it was a triangular craft, silent and hovering, that if you felt a connection to your heart and heard directions in your mind. Now, did you see a UFO?
I did, and the rest of the account, it was unidentified flying object, okay? It's like it's unidentified. I saw something. Now, to answer your question.
Yeah, and then he got into the thing about the percentages, and Tim was arguing about percentages. So, which brings up an interesting issue. Over at the Daily Kos, Marcos, you know, the guy who runs Daily Kos, is blogging that, first of all, pointing out that Mike Gravel, who was excluded from the debate last night, was excluded because he's basically raised no money, $287,000. The news media these days, they're saying, if you can't raise $1 million, you can't prove that you're a serious candidate, and or get 5% of the vote, 5% in a poll, excuse me, in Iowa and New Hampshire. And Microval has not hit either of those thresholds. And so, legitimately, he should be excluded. Now, and I agree with that, by the way. I think when Mike Revelle, in my opinion, just went down in flames when they said, you know, sir, you've declared bankruptcy. What do you have to say about that? And he was like, you know, the people of America should thank me for declaring bankruptcy. That credit card company that he had charged something, $20,000 or something on his credit card to pay for his campaign, this program that he has to change the Constitution or whatever it is. I mean, he actually was on this show talking about it about a year ago. We did about a 20-30 minute interview with him on it. And it just seemed unnecessarily convoluted to me, frankly, at the time. And it never caught fire, you know, and he declared bankruptcy based on that. And he justified that by saying, you know, it was a good thing for America and the credit card company deserved it. I don't think the credit card company deserved it. I'm sorry. And I don't, you know, if you're going to take a political stance or if you're going to start a business or something like that, and it's just, you know, you take your chances. Now, if you have an illness or if you get overextended for reasons that you can't control, if you get unemployed, if suddenly you're unemployed, if your employer cuts your pay, if you get divorced and you lose part of your income, I think it's entirely appropriate that we have protection. But I think Gravel just absolutely shot himself in the foot. And, you know, he's not a serious candidate. Now, the next step, though, is where Marcos over at the Daily Kos is saying about excluding Gravel. He says, this is eminently reasonable. If it was up to me, I'd cut Biden and Kucinich. Now, I'd like to take issue with that. I would not cut Biden and Kucinich. And the reason why is because Biden and Kucinich are contributing something significant to the debate. Let's keep in mind these are debates. Now, you know, we all know really what they are as serial talking points and sound bites, but to the extent that they can be debates in the modern era with the modern media and all this kind of stuff, I guess they are. And Dennis Kucinich is saying things that need to be said. And Joe Biden is saying things that need to be said regularly. Joe Biden is a foreign, I don't agree with all of his foreign policies, but he's a foreign policy genius. I've met the guy. I have talked with him. Joe Biden really understands foreign policy. That's not to say nobody else does. But he has some things to bring to the table that I think are really important. His voice needs to be heard, and I hope whoever is elected, assuming the Democrat is elected, and if it's not Joe Biden, I hope he ends up a Secretary of State or a serious advisor to that person because he really understands this stuff. And Dennis Kucinich, I mean, right across the board, pick your issue. Dennis Kucinich is the guy who really understands or who is really taking the truly progressive positions. And by being there on that platform, they are keeping everybody else honest. And, you know, for better or for worse, that, in my opinion, is an important function. They're doing that. So I disagree with Marcos's suggestion that Biden and Kucinich should be dropped from the Democratic debate. I do agree that Mike Gravel should have been dropped. He's been going nowhere with his campaign. His campaign was based on mostly his being a curmudgeon. I mean, last time he was on this show, which was not about his bankruptcy, it was about his campaign. My sense of it was the Mike Gravel curmudgeon. It's just, you know. So what are the real issues? Again, over at the Daily Kos is a great, by the way, Edwards leading almost 3-1 in who won the debate over at the Daily Kos. If you want to look at how progressives are viewing this thing, who won the debate. But nonetheless, what are the real issues? Bogged down in spending billions in Iraq, 38% of Democrats concerned about this. Leaders have done nothing about health care, 34% of Democrats concerned about this. Losing jobs to China and India, 29%. Doing nothing on dependence on oil and global warming, 26%. Government is running record budget deficits, 22%. Borders left unprotected, 21%. Government failed in Katrina, 15%. Interesting, the priorities. I'm curious what your thoughts are on what the priorities are and who did what and how and how well last night. And should Biden and Kucinich be bumped off the panel? And anything else you want to bring up about last night's debate? I thought it was a fascinating debate. I thought it was one of the best. And I thought everybody comported themselves very, very well. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
34 minutes past the hour. Happy Halloween. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. By the way, this Saturday, I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico at Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. Northwest Corner Tramway in Kendall area, signing Cracking the Code. On Monday of next week, Monday, November 5th, I'll be at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon, at 7:30 p.m. And on Friday of next week, November 9th, KPHX is sponsoring a gig at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills in Tempe from 3 to 5 p.m., where I'll be talking about and then signing Cracking the Code. Tickets are on sale at 1480kphx.com for those of you listening in the Phoenix area. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Doug in Los Angeles, you want to set me straight on Obama. Please do.
Yeah, I was just shocked for you to say that he's taking money from PACs and lobbyists, which is absolutely not the case. And
then,
you know it.
Then, well, no, I don't. Please fill me in here. What differentiates...
But this is new information to you that Edwards said last night that he and Obama aren't taking money from PACs. This is
right.
New information to you?
No. I agree with you on the PACs. The lobbyist part...
Well, then why did you say
You're right, and I misspoke. I'll acknowledge that.
Okay.
Obama is not taking money from PACs, and neither is John Edwards.
And he's not taking money from federal lobbyists either. And neither.
Now, that I didn't know. That I didn't know.
Well, it stated
so
all
what
the
is
time.
It? What is it?
And look at the legal compliances, you'll see that.
Yeah. Thank you, Doug. And tell me then, what is it that Obama and Hillary have in common in their fundraising that Edwards is different from them? Because I thought it was taking money from lobbyists. And apparently I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong to lump in Obama and Hillary.
So what is it that Obama and Hillary are doing in common that Edwards is doing differently?
I don't know. I don't think there is anything that Obama and Hillary are doing in common when compared to John Edwards. I mean, it's more... The separation is what is Edwards and Obama doing that is different than Hillary.
Right, which is not taking money from PACs. Right.
Which is not taking money from PACs or lobbyists.
Okay.
Edwards and Obama have the same position on that.
Okay, great. Doug, thank you very much for setting the record straight. I appreciate the call. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I wanted to say that I think that Kucinich's speech about seeing the UFO was great, in that we should have more candidates, Democrat and Republican, who are willing to stand there and tell us the truth. And when they do, we shouldn't condemn them. We should applaud them.
I was not condemning him at all. I thought it was great that he said it. In fact, I said, I think I've seen a UFO.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that you did. To oversimplify, but I think that there are two groups of people here in America right now. One group is so scared and cowardly that they would shoot their own mama if the media said that she was Al-Qaeda and give any justification. The other group, however, has the courage to choose to fight for the weak and the defenseless. In other countries, in our country, even if it means going against their own president. You know, real men defend the weak.
Yeah. Well said, Andre. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, very well said. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi, Tom. You know, the number one issue for us should still be, most of all, electability, because it's going to tighten up when it comes down to November. And, you know, really, I guess Marcos at the Daily Kos has his preferences. He'd probably like to see Obama or Edwards. I think the most electable by far, if it were put up one against whoever the Republican's going to be, is Joe Biden. I think he handles himself incredibly well compared to all of the others when it comes to just cutting to the chase of what issues are. And,
I think I agree. He handles himself very well. I think that Chris Dodd does too, and he's very solid on the issues. Why have neither of these guys gotten the kind of national traction that Obama and Hillary have? Is it because of the novelty of an African American and a woman running for, and then the media is focusing on that? Or is there, is it because the message is different? I mean, in your opinion?
It's all personality. It's all who the media finds easiest to cover because they heard the story before. And I strongly believe that just like when it came down to the 2004 primaries, that people are just starting to shift their focus onto this. And I think, you know, from what I hear in Iowa, that people who meet Biden want to vote for him, except they're not sure he can win. And when it, you know, if you started stripping away one after the other until you got down to Hillary and any other male, any other candidate, obviously, all the others being male, I think Hillary would only go up maybe 10-15% more, from 30-40% or so, because people don't feel that they want the fight in the future that's going to be required. Even if she gets in, it will be a fight. So hopefully, you know, people,
in that case, it may be that the mainstream media, being by and large Republican, at least in management, you know, because it's all about the business interests, right? And most of our media is multinational corporations. It may be that the mainstream media has decided that the most unelectable Democrats are Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and therefore they're going to focus most of their attention on them. I mean, that's kind of the conspiracy theory view of it.
I think it's the horse race and the ease of it all. Just this morning, CNN was running a story I saw yesterday in the Times about Halloween costumes that show too much skin for young girls. Because they saw the story and they went with it. Why think up something new? We've got
We don't have the bottom line, Len, and you said it well. We don't have news in this country anymore. We have infotainment. In response to the caller before last, I mean, this is what I was thinking of. This story from the Los Angeles Times by Don Morin, April 22nd, 2007. You can Google it. I'm reading it on Common Dreams. April 22, 2007, Los Angeles Times. I'll just read it straight up, by Don Morin. While pledging to turn down donations from lobbyists themselves, Senator Barack Obama raised more than $1 million in the first 3 months of his presidential campaign from law firms and companies that have major lobbying operations in the nation's capital. Portraying himself as a new-style politician determined to reform Washington, Obama makes his policy clear in fundraising invitations, stating that he takes no donations from, quote, federal lobbyists, end quote. His aides announced last week he was returning $43,000 to lobbyists who had donated to his campaign. But the Illinois Democrats' policy of shunning money from lobbyists registered to do business on Capitol Hill does not extend to lawyers whose partners lobby there, nor does the ban apply to corporations that have major lobbying operations in Washington. And the prohibition does not extend to lobbyists who ply their trade in such state capitals as Springfield, Illinois, Tallahassee, Florida, and Sacramento, even though they may deal with national clients and issues. Stephen Weissman of the Campaign Finance Institute says clearly the distinction is not that significant. He gets an asterisk that he says he's trying to be different, but overall the same wealthy interests are funding his campaign as are funding other candidates, whether or not they are lobbyists. End of quote. And I'm not saying this because I'm opposed to Barack Obama. I think he'd make a great president. And if he was the nominee of the party, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat. But, you know, the mind-boggling amounts of money that are being accumulated by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are not coming, by and large. Are not coming from grassroots donors. I know a large portion of them are, and Barack Obama is getting much, much more, much, much more in grassroots donations than Hillary Clinton. But anyhow, this is starting to sound way too partisan, and that's not the road that I wanted to go down. Janelle in Kenmore, Washington. Hey, Janelle.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk about, you know, the debate and some of the issues that you're talking about. I was listening to the comments afterward, and I think it was Tim Russert that made the comment, something to the effect of the number one issue that's going to affect voters was going to be this New York giving driver's license to immigrants.
Right, to illegal aliens.
Illegal aliens. And I found that comment maddening that he said that's the number one issue.
But he's right in as much as the Republicans will make it the number one issue. Trust me, they will. This is going to be the new you know, gays, guns, and God. This is going to be it. And
well,
I think
you're hitting on part of what I was going to say is, but I think it's kind of twofold. A, I think it's putting the focus back on Hillary, which I definitely think the media wants the focus on Hillary, and I personally think it's because she's big business, and I think Edwards said that really well last night. The media is big business, and I think Hillary's a new big business candidate. And I think the second is sort of what you're getting at, is that immigration is what I call the look at the monkey. I mean, it takes you off of the real issues, you know, war, campaign refinance, NAFTA, which I had hardly ever heard them talk about, healthcare, environment, and they talk about something like immigration.
It's unfortunately it doesn't start with G, or we'd have a fourth G to add to it. Now it's GGGI, you know, God, gays, guns, and immigrants, right? But it's you know, anything but real issues. Yeah, exactly. You know, very well said, Janelle, and thank you very much for calling and saying it. No, you're spot on. But I'm telling you, if she does not come out strongly against what Spitzer's doing, you know, it may sell well in New York State. And if she was just running for senator from New York, she may not have a problem. I don't know the politics of New York State that well. But I'm telling you, nationally, that issue is going to eat her alive if she doesn't do something about it. 45 minutes past that.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Empire's money.
Vampires, mummies, oh man, some of the lumpings together for Halloween are absolutely strange. Hey, happy Halloween, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Frightening news on this Halloween day. It looks as if Henry Waxman has written a letter to the White House. He wants their documents that relate to the Abramoff scandal, and apparently there are hundreds and hundreds of pages. It looks like most of the Abramoff people and some of the White House people would not talk. Of course, a lot of the White House people didn't talk because they were claiming executive privilege. But Matt Schlapp, S-C-H-L-A-P-P. Apparently, he was former White House political director. He cooperated with the committee's investigation, and he estimated, apparently, according to Henry Waxman's letter, that he had monthly contact with Jack Abramoff on subjects involving government business. The Waxman's committee wants this information, and the White House has not been forthcoming on that one.
I'm telling you, the Republican Party and the Bush administration are being run like the mafia. You know, Mike Malloy has been referring for all the way back 6 years ago when Mike and I were on IE America Radio together, when we started, you know, when I started out on Sirius Satellite and whatnot. He was calling it the Bush crime family. The whole thing is being run like the mob. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre.
Well, it certainly is. It's an interesting group of people. They also the president.
You're very diplomatic, Ellen.
Yes. Don't forget, I have to work at the White House.
I understand.
Lots of there is the president today spoke at the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and of all places, he took a real hit at the Democrats on health care, particularly SCHIP. Said that the Democrats were trying to federalize health care incrementally, and of course, using the SCHIP as that.
But he's right.
Well,
he's right,
and
I think it's a great thing, and I think most Democrats think it's a great thing, and I think a significant minority, maybe even a small majority of Republicans, think it's a good thing.
Well, obviously, that's why they've had so many votes on that SCHIP, because people in their districts are flipping out that they can't get health care. And you know, what's interesting, and just for a little talk radio news, we have to have everybody get their own individual policy because of my eye problems, and we're so small, we can't get a group policy.
Wow. This is where it just breaks down. I mean, it's the same thing when Louise and I were living in Vermont, and when we were independently syndicating this show in the first couple of years of this show, we had to join the local chamber of commerce in order, you know, we had a small corporation that owns the show, still do, and we had to join the local chamber of commerce and in order to be able to get into a group insurance plan that was provided by the chamber, which was a strange experience to say the least, but you know, that was the only way to do it. You had to find some group that would take you in.
That's absolutely true, and it's been very, very difficult for us. Yeah. And obviously for many, many Americans, what, 48 million are uninsured, and then another 30 or 40 million are underinsured, you know, with just really lousy policies. Also, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, there's a chair by the name of Nancy Nord, and the Speaker of the House, Pelosi, has asked that she resign. Several other people have asked that she resign. This has a lot to do with these Chinese toys and all this kind of thing. But apparently, the Congress wanted to expand the Consumer Product Safety Commission so that they could look into this, and she is against them expanding the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Can you imagine? I mean, a bureaucrat not wanting their area expanded. Well, clearly this is coming from other places, and they're doing this because they are so concerned about you know, the fact that it somehow might ruin our trade with China.
And in fact, she even went on to say that she opposed making it easier to bring criminal prosecutions. This is, I'm quoting from the New York Times now. She opposed making it easier to bring criminal prosecutions of companies that knowingly sell defective products. She was critical of a provision to ban lead from toys. And she, she has asked lawmakers in two letters not to approve the bulk of the legislation that would increase her own agency's authority, double its budget, and sharply increase its dwindling staff. She wants to see her own agency disappear.
And this morning, she said she was not going to resign, that she believed that she was doing a good job protecting the people. A very interesting thing going on. I call it, this is part, it's the same theme. I'm always looking for themes here, and you're getting the theme of, well, we can't increase the budget of these consumer protection. Well, now the State Department Inspector General, who's under a lot of criticism, is going to have, I guess, two hearings about his work in front of Waxman's committee and one other committee at Congress, is saying that his tight budget blocked these overseas probes. And what's interesting is that the whistleblowers in his office said that they were stopped from going into Afghanistan. They were stopped from going into Iraq to look at contract fraud. And so he's saying, well, we just didn't have enough money to send anybody over. And, I don't have enough money to do my investigation. Trust me, we're now going to hear this thematically from department to department. We already got to
the department. They have enough money to give hundreds of billions of dollars to contractors. They don't have the few million dollars it would cost to send an investigator over to look at the books and make sure that those hundreds of billions of dollars were correctly spent. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, my friend.
That's mind-boggling.
Can
you imagine during the Teapot Dome scandal if Harding had tried that? I mean, I'm aghast. I'm astounded. It takes a lot to astound me. I'm astounded.
By the way, we just got the White House briefing has just ended, and on this Abramoff-Waxman issue, Dana Perina said the request now before us regard internal documents and internal deliberations that we're not going to turn over. I will not say we're exerting executive privilege.
Yeah,
she said they turned over all the documents they're going to turn over.
Oh, boy. Another big cover-up coming out of the White House.
Yeah,
well,
off the presses.
let us hope that the mustache of justice, Henry Waxman, can prevail on this. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes what you do know isn't what you thought you knew or should know or whatever. And sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
As the Firesign Theater would say, would you put pig's eyes in your martini? Would you eat fried scorpions, live maggots, fresh stink bugs, or deadly serpents sliced live at the table? Tonight, perfect for Halloween night, tonight, National Geographic Channel featuring a new show, or a show, a special, Taboo, Gross Food. And it's premiering tonight. And Gene Rurka, who is the exotic food chairman at the Explorers Club, is with us. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, Gene. So, is this, pig's eyes in your martini? I mean, this has got to be over the top.
Well, I don't know if it's over the top. I also want to question the word gross here. Gross to some, as I've mentioned in the past, is a delight to others. It's based on cultures. So, we've got to be a little bit more open-minded to it. So, gross might not be the case. Adventurous, different, unique, unusual. Maybe mind-opening, maybe a little bit more exploration to the palate. Alternative foods, like alternative fuels, we've got to try new things. So tonight,
well, in fact, I have to tell you, Gene, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine who is Japanese, Louise and I were staying at his home in Japan, and I've known the guy for years, and it just had never occurred to me that he never ate dairy products. And we went out to a restaurant, he was looking for some American food, went to a pizza place. And you had to ask to have cheese on your pizza. And, I got cheese on the pizza, and he kind of winced. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, you realize that is the secretion of the mammary gland of a 2,000-pound mammal that has then been allowed to rot. And I'm like, whoa. And that's apparently how the Japanese think of cheese.
And that's a wake-up call. And, again, cultural differences. And I don't think we should knock any of them. We're just not used to it.
Yeah, and in fact, one time in Japan, and this was back in the 70s, I owned a company that was negotiating with a Japanese company, and I was the VP, actually, of this company, and the VP of that company, because he always tried to get equality in that culture, took me out to a fancy, fancy, fancy place for dinner, where it was just businessmen. They had this long tray, or this long counter, rather, with frying things, frying fat and trays, and the guy, and all these little trays with little bugs and weird things, and he stuck a straw right through a giant black beetle, dipped the thing in some batter, and his legs were squirming around, stuck it in the fryer, and then handed it to me. And it was like everything was bugs. And this was like, this was supposed to impress me. I mean, this was like the really cool place. Louise and I going through the night markets in Taipei and in Bangkok, mostly in Taipei in particular, and in Shenzhen in China. You see the weirdest stuff. So you're right.
Well,
it's
weird
cultural.
To us, but normal to them. And keep in mind, we're very blessed to be in a country where we have choices. But most of our people never get beyond about 99% of our people never get more exotic than maybe a duck or goose. Normally it's beef, it's pork, it's some fowl of some type, but, we do
eat ducks and geese.
We do eat oysters, we do eat crabs, and there's not much of a difference between a crab and a tarantula.
Right. In fact, I point that out to my friends who eat crabs. I don't. I say, you realize you're eating a giant spider.
How about
arachnids, right?
Clam on a half shell.
Yeah.
A living organism. You don't want it to be dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want it at all. Thanks. I consider that gross food. Okay, Gene. So tonight, the National Geographic Channel, you're going to be sharing with your viewers the weirdest foods from all over the world, right?
Well, I think we're going to have some unique foods. Weird, I don't know about that, but we're going to introduce people to a very diverse, unusual menu. It might not be for all people, but I think they'll enjoy experiencing it through the TV.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a fine thing. Gene, thanks a lot for dropping by. We appreciate it. Gene Rurka, he's the exotic food chairman at the Explorers Club, and tonight the show is Taboo, Gross Food, premiering tonight on the National Geographic Channel. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Christopher in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Christopher, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First thing, commenting on your
points about the politics that are being addressed in the debates. My personal feeling, I've been following politics for 40 years or so. My personal feeling is that I've never seen this country in such a dire state, and I think it's the Constitution has been assaulted, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that calls for bringing us back to basics. And I think those basics are we got to get our vote back. And I'm a technology guy, and I'll tell you, electronics do not belong in the vote process.
Yeah, particularly electronics owned by a private for-profit corporation, and
80%
of us are going to be voting that way.
Windows-based, no less. You know, it's almost crazy.
Yeah.
Federally funded elections, we've got to do that to save our democracy. I mean, it's just we've got to get the money at least moderated to some degree.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is reestablishing antitrust. Now, none of those things are being brought up on the public forum, and yet I hear you talking about them, and you know, it's below the radar. And yet
you know why they're not, Christopher? And I really think that this is my personal conspiracy theory, but I think it's right. I remember 4 years ago, Louise and I were watching on Chris Matthews, actually. It was Hardball, and he was talking to Howard Dean. And at that point, Howard Dean was on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and he was the fair-haired boy. I mean, everybody thought he was going to be the presidential nominee, and as such, he would easily knock out Bush. And frankly, had he been the Democratic nominee, he would have easily knocked out Bush. And Chris asked him about media consolidation in the media, and he said that he thought that the big media should be broken up. And Chris looked absolutely shocked, and he said, you realize, we're right now on a network that's owned by General Electric. And Howard Dean was like, yep, break it up. And I turned to Louise and I said, that's the last good press Howard Dean's going to ever get anywhere from the corporate media. And sure enough, it was like a light switch had been thrown. The next day, the national networks were talking about the angry Howard Dean. And Howard Dean never again got good press. And so I think that there are some things, tragically, there are some things that the nominees simply cannot talk about until they're president. And because the system is so corrupted by this, yes, the Sherman Antitrust Act is the ultimate cure for probably 80% of what ails us right now. But nobody can talk about it until they actually have the power, and we just have to look at the nominees and ask ourselves which one is the most likely to assert that power. Although to their credit, both John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich have talked about this at some length, and they they're not going as far as. Actually, John Edwards or Kucinich has, but Edwards has not gone as far as Howard Dean has. Because, like I said, I think it's just it's media suicide. But your point is well taken and very well said, Chris. Thanks a lot for the call, Donna in Taylor, Michigan. Hey, Donna, welcome to the program.
Hi, I was listening to that gentleman from the Ayn Rand before, I went to work when I was 15 in my. Late 30s, I became disabled. The money that was put away into my pension turned out not to be there through the company I worked for. And I get by on about $600 a month on Social Security. It's not easy, but I just think that is just ridiculous, the idea of getting rid of that. And I have some relatives in Canada. Disability there, you get $1,700 a month, plus you get your full medical. And then I also have relatives in the UK. And over there, if you're disabled, you get the equivalent. It's £1,400, which is about $2,800 a month. Plus
right.
They have
the
a
pound
program.
Actually is at $2.05 right now. So,
yeah, plus they have a program where every few years you get a new car because you're disabled. So, if you are physically handicapped, well, you can't get around, you can't walk, arthritis, things like that, where they provide you with a new car every few years.
Right. The idea is we don't have poor houses anymore. The idea is that if we're going to have a middle class society, there actually is enough wealth to go around to have a middle class society. It may mean that a few billionaires are not going to become multi-billionaires, but we can have a society where everybody can have a decent middle class life and they don't have to scrimp and save and they don't have to make choices between dog food and prescription medicines.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're absolutely right, Donna. I know dozens of people.
Without Social Security, I know people who wouldn't have a home, who wouldn't be able to eat. It's ridiculous. And it's just, these are evil people running our country.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say evil. I'd say misguided. But the consequences of their being misguided is evil behavior and evil policy. I'll go along with that. Donna, thank you so much for the call. It's good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to us there on WDTW in Detroit. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio. Larry Scott going to fill us in on what's going on with the VA. VAWatchdog.org, right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Yes, it's Halloween. Back when I was a kid, it was trick-or-treat for UNICEF. Remember going around door-to-door asking for pennies and nickels and sending the money off? I guess these days pennies and nickels just don't go that far, thanks to 26 years of Reaganomics. Larry Scott's with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
You're right, Tom, and happy Halloween to you.
Well, thank you, and happy Halloween to you, too. Looks like we're going to get a new head of the Veterans Administration. Tell
us about
this.
Isn't that interesting? And in keeping with the holiday, Tom, do you think this is a trick or a treat? Come on, just take a wild guess.
Coming from Bush, it's got to be a trick.
It's got to be a trick, all right. He's an Army retired lieutenant general, also doctor. His name is James Peake. And believe me, it's a trick. You know what this is? This nomination for Secretary of Veterans Affairs, the head of the VA, is kind of like one of those candy-coated apples that you get at Halloween. You know, it's all pretty and shiny with all the sugar and the coating on the outside, but then you bite in and you've got yourself a rotten apple. And that's
Looking at him from the outside, it looked like here's a guy who's been in the military most of his life. He would know what veterans' issues are. Finally, the administration appointed somebody who wasn't just some big Republican contributor.
And
what's wrong with the guy?
That's exactly what it looks like on the outside. About 40 years in the Army, he's an MD, two Purple Hearts and a Silver Star from Vietnam, a lieutenant general, that's three stars, you're getting up there, and he was Surgeon General of the Army. That's the top doctor in the Army from 2000 to 2004. We bite into that apple, we find a lot of problems. From 2000 to 2004, as Surgeon General of the Army, Dr. James Peake was the man responsible for Walter Reed Army Hospital.
Oops.
Now, we've got to take a long look at that. Only one senator on Capitol Hill has come out and said, this is interesting. I wonder what he's going to have to say about that when it comes time to question him. And that's Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, who is a member of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. And I can
and
guarantee
very good on these issues.
But she's wonderful. And I can guarantee you she is going to grill this man when she gets him up there. We have some.
Now,
other
is this fair, Larry? I mean, you know, Secretary, as the Surgeon General of the Army, I mean, he's got to be responsible for thousands of medical facilities and tens of thousands of employees at the very least. Is it really fair to condemn him simply for what happened at Walter Reed?
Yes.
Or was that so large and conspicuous that only an idiot would be unaware of it?
No, because that was the next step in the conversation, Tom, and that is the man is an incredible fiscal conservative, and just over the last day we've been able to dig out a lot of his writings talking about his responsibility to the taxpayers, keeping the cost of medical care in the Army down, and how efficient he was at doing that. We saw that at Walter Reed, where under his command we had lots of positions outsourced at that hospital. That was his doing. So while he was not sitting at Walter Reed and in a hands-on position, his policies and his declarations from above did have an impact on that, and I think we have to take a long look at it. We've also got to look at the fact that Dr. Peake really has no knowledge of how the VA works. He's been on the military side. The VA is something entirely different. Two other things, and one I know you're going to find very interesting, but first of all, he pushes the Dole Shalala Commission agenda, which we've talked about. This is the agenda that President Bush wants that's going to entirely rewrite the Veterans Disability Benefits system as we know it. It's going to give maybe three levels of compensation to veterans that will be means tested every few years. It's going to turn the system into a shambles. But here's the good one. Former Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Anthony Principi, from 2000 to 2004, ran a company called QTC. QTC he still owns. And it's rather interesting that when he left the VA and went back to QTC, they got a contract to do physical examinations for the VA, which over the next few years is going to bring them somewhere between $1 and $2 billion. Interesting, eh? Guess what Dr. Peake does now? He's the chief medical officer and chief operating officer of QTC.
Oh, this is, it's the corrupt revolving door.
It's the revolving door. It goes round and round and round. This man,
it's how the Republicans pay off their buddies.
He is going to be in a position to again, and of course he'll deny that it would ever happen, but to funnel business back to his company and to the company of a former Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Anthony Principe. So what we've got is you go to the military, you go to the private sector, you go to government, you get out of government, and you feed the contracts back to the private company, to the private sector again, and you sit and you're happy in your retirement. So there are five very good reasons right there why Dr. James Peake should not be confirmed as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and I hope the Senate does the right thing and just says, I'm sorry, we're not going to send your name forward to the full Senate for a vote.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, and uses it, frankly, as an opportunity to expose the corruption and cronyism that's so endemic, not just in this administration, but that is part of basically the fundamental governing philosophy of the Republican Party these days.
And that's all this is. This is a payoff. This is a payoff to a guy. He's done his 40 years in the military, and they're saying, okay, now sit here for the next 14 months, take care of this, and you'll be fine when it's all over.
Right. Yeah. Amazing. Well, you can read all about it over at VAWatchdog.org. Keep an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry Scott, the founder and editor and the chief cook and bottle washer there. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Happy Halloween again.
Thank you. And the same to you, Larry. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Hey, Halloween devil, no doubt. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Doug, who had called in to take me on about saying that there was some distinction between John Edwards and Barack Obama in taking money from lawyers and lobbyists, etc., shares a clip from the Washington Post that notes a spokesman for Edwards, Eric Schultz, said there's a clear distinction between refusing to take money from lobbyists and taking money from the people who employ them. He said either you lobby the federal government or you don't. Either you're paid to influence legislation, the people who write it, or you're not. The line is clear and only murky for those who are trying to blur it. And then goes on to say, Obama gets points for acknowledging that the line he is attempting to draw is a vague one and that all presidential candidates are tainted by their frantic efforts to raise money. Quote, this is Barack Obama, quote, the argument is not that I'm pristine because I'm swimming in the same muddy water as the other candidates. He told reporters in Iowa back in August, the argument is that I know it's muddy and I want to clean it up. So I stand corrected and congratulations, Barack Obama. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Marty in L.A. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom, last night's debate was very telling to me. I'm sort of a broken record. I'm sort of share your beliefs on John Edwards. I'd vote for any Democrat, but he's much preferable to me at this point. And watching the debate last night, if Hillary Clinton thinks she was attacked last night, as Jolson said, she ain't seen nothing yet. If she's one-on-one with the Republican, it's not going to be a swift boat. It's going to be a whole armada. And I think that the other thing, too, is, you know, there's a bunch of Senate seats that are up, and I know you're aware of them. There's open seats in Colorado, New Mexico, and a real big one in Virginia. And is Mark Warner going to want bring Hillary Clinton in there as a candidate of his party, or would he be more comfortable with John Edwards? Easy question, easy answer.
And in that context, by the way, if Richardson doesn't win place or draw, you know, nothing's happening for Richardson. Is he going to be running for Pete Domenici's seat in New Mexico?
That would be a good thing. The thing too about Iowa, Tom, is I think of the three main candidates, I think whoever runs third in Iowa is going to have a problem. Expectation level for Hillary is high. If she runs third, it's going to be, you know, she's really the headlines, you know, will be in the paper. If Edwards runs third, they're going to say, well, he gave it a good try, etc. So that's why it's so important there. And I think the Democrats have to be a little more pragmatic. There's also a couple of Democratic seats that might be vulnerable too, like Mary Landrieu because of the displacement of the Katrina people.
And
Tim Johnson in South Dakota. And I think that I don't think that either one of them would want to bring Hillary in there to help them with their reelection.
Well, it's hard to say. You know, a lot is going to depend on how effective she is at campaigning. You know, if she is the nominee, and how effective she is at campaigning, and how effective the Republicans are at swift boating her. And the fact of the matter is, Marty, and you and I both know it, they will swift boat anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they'll go after, if it's Barack Obama, they'll go after him because his middle name is Hussein, and they'll say that he went to a madrasa in, you know, when he was a kid in Indonesia, which is simply the Muslim word for school, but they'll turn it into something sinister. If it's John Edwards, they're going to go after him for his haircut. They are going to swift, or something else. God only knows what. They will swift boat anybody, no matter what.
Yeah. I think that Edwards is sort of inoculated, though, for the reasons we might not like, but the fact that, you know, he's lost a son and his wife's health situation. I think if he gets relentlessly attacked, it's going to backfire on the Republicans.
It may well, and also he's already been through all this. I mean, he's been vetted through the process by running for vice president 4 years ago, and as a consequence of that, if there's any dirt to be dug, it's been dug.
Yeah.
And if there's any mud that can be slung, it's been slung, you know, excepting anything that might have happened in the last 4 years. Good point, Marty. Thanks a lot for the call. I do appreciate it. Irving in New York City. Hey, Irving, what's up?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, I am a senior citizen. I was in the Second World War, but I guess that's irrelevant at the moment.
No, thank you. Thank you for saving democracy.
Well, actually, Roosevelt, I think, saved capitalism, but that's another. You see, what bothers me, and the main reason why I'm calling, is that there's so many what I call fairy tales or lies that American people believe. For instance, the concept that capitalism or so-called free enterprise equals freedom, and that's not true. You, in fact, if you have laissez-faire, and if you have capitalism go to an extreme where they get bigger and bigger with no government controls, you eventually get fascism. That happened in Italy, in the Second World War.
Yeah, and Spain, and it's slowly happening here.
Right. So the point is, but a lot of people think that if you have laissez-faire, it equals freedom. And really, that basic concept has to be shown that it's false. Completely.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Irving. You're absolutely right, and I totally agree with you, and I thank you so much.
May I just say something else, sir?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
No, I also wanted to bring out the point that if those people who are for capitalism, and I believe in a limited kind of capitalism where you have controls over it, however, you also should take the best of other systems. Certain things should not be for profit, for instance, like police and firemen and health. Should not be for profit. That's the thing.
Right.
Everybody seems to think that if you throw everything for profit, it's better. Certain things are wrong to have for profit. Somebody should not make a profit on your health care. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. You said it very well. Thank you. And I totally agree with you. And in fact, proof that capitalism doesn't equal democracy. Just look at China. Here you have a totalitarian communist dictatorship that is the most successful capitalist economy in the world right now, growing at 11.5% annual rate. Back about 8 or 10 years ago, when I was writing a lot on attention deficit disorder and education and learning disabilities, I was invited to Singapore to give a talk. And Singapore, arguably one of the most successful capitalist nations, you know, heavy, heavy capitalist nations, just a powerhouse in Asia. Absolute powerhouse. And you can get arrested for chewing gum in Singapore. The taxi drivers had a little thing in his taxi, so whenever he hit the speed limit, it would start going ding, 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 so he wouldn't go over the speed limit. In giving my talk, one of the people in the audience said, you know, because I'd made some suggestions about how to reform schools, one of the people in the audience said, well, what can we do? How do we get these kinds of reforms in our schools? And being the naive American that I am, I said, you should get politically active. Lobby your legislators. I was assuming that Singapore was a democracy. And you know, I said, you know, and there was a shocked silence. And afterwards, the conference organizer said to me, you know, I hope I don't get in trouble for what you said. And he was very polite. I mean, that was that. And I was staying at I'm not going to name the hotel, but it's one of the top five hotels in Singapore, and a very, very fancy schmancy hotel, and, you know, with a huge, like, 70-story atrium and everything. Went back to my hotel room, And every drawer in my room had been taken out and flipped upside down. The bed had been slid off. All my clothes were taken. The room was totally trashed. And so I went to hotel security and I said, you know, my room was trashed. And they didn't say, yes, the police were here, they did it. But they made it quite clear by what they didn't say that that's what happened. You know, because I had argued in favor at a public forum of people getting politically active. Democracy and capitalism are not interchangeable and intertwined. Capitalism is a great economic system as long as it is regulated and doesn't reach the cancer stage as it is beginning to in our society. And it will not inevitably lead to democracy. In fact, capitalism has been in place for most of the history of Europe, and it has led to monarchy. Anyhow, Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to say something about Hillary and the debate last night and the exact question that she got caught on. And this is a question that we as Democrats are going to have to be honest about. I'm a San Francisco liberal and proud of it. But to say that illegal immigration does not affect wages is simply false. And it's something we need to discuss honestly. I'm glad that you said you were not in favor of illegal immigrants having a driver's license. I agree with you. However, the discussion on it has been so factionalized and so framed by the media as being a liberal conservative debate, and it's not.
No, it's not. It absolutely is not. And I first started writing about this 3 years ago in Common Dreams. In fact, the original pushback against immigrants being brought into the United States in order to break labor unions and drive down the cost of labor was in the 1880s when the railroads began importing people from China specifically to break the unions. And that led to specifically relatively racist laws against Chinese immigration. It was kind of a coalition of the labor folks and the racist folks, tragically. And that's what's happening now is you've got this coalition of the right-wing paranoids and the racist folks. But the reality is that we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And as long as employers are not subject to penalties, then you're going to have people from all over the world coming over here to work. And it's really quite simple. And when you increase the labor pool like that in a relatively unrestricted way, as David Ricardo pointed out in 1816 in his book On Labor, it will drive down the cost of labor to subsistence levels, you know, in other words, the working poor, and that's what we've had ever since Reagan did his amnesty in 86, in part. And now immigration is not, in my opinion, the major factor in all this. I think our trade policies are the major factor, but it is a significant factor. And that is the progressive position, oddly enough. Cesar Chavez led a march from the Simi Valley down to the Mexican border to protest illegal immigration from Mexico into the United States because it was busting up the United Farm Workers Union. And so, Kim, thank you for calling and saying it and giving me an opportunity to. I think that it's entirely appropriate to say I'm liberal and I believe that every nation should have a membrane that protects its economy called immigration laws. And I say that as somebody who has worked in other countries with permits. 45 minutes.
Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
We were hiking past the White House late one night when our eyes beheld an eerie sight. The president appeared with folks very strange, the zombies and vampires of global climate change. It's not global warming, say oil company disciples. Our math tells us it's natural weather cycles. These claims from industry heavies, let the president rest behind his own protective levees.
It's the Climate Mash, Boris Pickett. Welcome back. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, broadcasting live from Los Angeles to New York and zillions of places in between. John Edwards on the line with us. Senator Edwards, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Tom.
I am so pleased to have you on the program, and I want to specifically thank you for coming on this program without giving me a list of questions to ask you or a list of questions that I can't ask you, which I will tell you right up front. Other candidates have said those were the only terms on which they would come on this program, and I'm unwilling to have them on under those terms. Thank you for coming on with no preconditions. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. I'm happy to do that.
I honor it. And my listeners know that I've given money to Dennis Kucinich once and to you five times. Every time I do, I announce it on the air. So I guess there's a certain bias here that my listeners are familiar with. So in any case, last night's debate, any thoughts on what happened last night that you'd like to just toss out here before we get into
it? You mean in the debate?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think the debate was a defining moment in the campaign. I think it became very clear during the debate what choices Democratic primary voters have. You know, they have a choice between the status quo, compromise, triangulation, bobbing and weaving, and somebody who actually believes the system is corrupt and it must be changed. We can't defend it. And if we don't change it, we're going to hand this mess over to our children and our grandchildren. There is a risk that our children don't have a better life than we have. And if we want to ensure that that happens, we're going to actually have to be willing to take on a system where the corruption has crept in over a period of 20 or 25 years.
Yeah. Well, there's been this declared and undeclared war against the middle class, started with Reagan, basically trying to roll back the New Deal. And many of us out here are waiting for, hoping for another Franklin Roosevelt, essentially, somebody who will say, yes, capitalism's fine as long as it's appropriately regulated. Your thoughts on the Sherman Antitrust Act? I think Jimmy Carter was the last president to really use it, breaking up AT&T.
Well, I think it's one of the tools that I would use as president to help deal with the extraordinary consolidation of business. By the way, we also have we need to be using the FCC to do something about the consolidation of media, because what's happened is we don't have the divergent democratic voices that we need in this country anymore. I mean, my basic view about it is that we've gotten to the place where we have a concentration of money and very wealthy people and big corporations, and they, as a result, have been able to corrupt the government. And it feeds the cycle of the government, instead of representing all Americans, representing the few. It's the few, not the many. And so it's a combination of a concentration of wealth with a concentration of power that unfortunately has allowed this government to be taken away from the American people.
Yeah, we're talking with Senator John Edwards. This has been a theme throughout all of your campaigns, I mean, for the Senate, for vice president, and now for president. Last night you mentioned Hillary Clinton's vote in favor of the Kyle Lieberman resolution. What are your concerns about the direction that we're going with regard to Iran? I realize this is probably a softball question, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about it.
We got to stop this president. We got to stop Cheney. These guys have been rattling the saber on Iran for years now. They've ratcheted up their saber rattling. They wanted to have the Senate say yes to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard being declared a terrorist organization. And, I guess you'd expect some Republicans to enable this president, but you wouldn't expect Democrats to do it. I mean, we know we got to stop it. And I just say two good Democrats who are running for president, Biden and Dodd, voted no, but Senator Clinton voted yes. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just you can't say you're going to stand up to Bush, and then when this neocon language, which is exactly what it was, that's in this resolution, comes before the Senate, you vote to enable Bush again. I mean, you just sooner or later, you got to stop it. And
right.
So that's my basic view about it, and I think it's hugely dangerous, and it's been proven to be correct because a few days ago, Bush and Cheney declared the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, a militia group inside Iran, a terrorist organization, and a proliferator of weapons of mass destruction. That language sounds very familiar because we've heard it in the lead-up to Iraq.
Yeah, scary echoes. How do you respond to those who suggest that your campaign, because you've taken money from trial lawyers and groups associated with them, is just as in bed with the establishment as Hillary Clinton, who has taken money from lobbyists and PACs, and Barack Obama, who doesn't take money from lobbyists and PACs, but has raised an enormous amount of money? What differentiates the three of you, for example, in that realm? And how do you respond to that accusation that's been tossed at you by
several? Let me say something about myself first. I've 93% of my contributors are people who give $250 or less. So the vast majority of my contributors give small amounts of money. Second, I've never taken a dime from a Washington lobbyist or a PAC, a special interest PAC, the entire time I've been in politics, including in my presidential campaign. But the point of this is not to pat me on the back. I'm not pure. Don't claim to be. You know, anybody who's raised millions of dollars cannot be pure. The answer, though, is, and here's the difference I have with Senator Clinton. I believe the system's broken. I believe we have to change it. I think it's corrupt. And Senator Clinton defends it. I mean, she says it's perfectly fine to continue taking money from lobbyists. It's perfectly fine, in her case, to be the biggest recipient of Washington lobbyist money of any candidate, Democrat or Republican. She's taking more money than any Republican candidate from Washington lobbyists. And actually, two of the most startling things, she's also taking more money from the health industry than any other candidate, Democrat or Republican, and more money from the defense industry. For goodness sakes, we're Democrats. How could that happen? So I don't think you can change the system unless you say no to that.
Senator John Edwards, thanks so much for being with us today, sir. Good luck.
Thanks for having me.
Much appreciated. Coming up tomorrow, Chuck Morse is going to be here for a debate about the California wildfires and the news of the day and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.